Well, we're going to begin the Energy Utilities Technology and Communications Committee. I'm hoping my committee members are hearing this and will be coming in very quickly. We're here today to listen to Dr. Masoud Amin, who will be talking to us about smart grid in Minnesota. And he has quite an extensive bio, and I couldn't do justice by trying to paraphrase it for you, but he is the Honeywell H.W. Sweat Chair and Director of the Technological Leadership Institute. He's a professor of electrical and computer engineering and university distinguished teaching professor at the University of Minnesota. And I would like to call him to the table, and he's willing to make a presentation for us on smart grid.
Thank you, Senator Solon. I'm honored to be here. May I present it standing up, or would you prefer if I sit?
We really need, and if you're willing to carry the microphone, you can present it standing up.
I would be delighted.
Those do come out of there.
Good afternoon. I'm honored to be here, and thank you very much for your leadership, for your hard work and efforts for the people of Minnesota. In the next 55, 60 minutes, I will share with you what is going on in smart grid, what is it, and together identify opportunities of what we can do to lead not only our region but our nation in the area of smart grid security, smart grid technology, and smart grid opportunities. Before I start, when you think about all the challenges, whether it is national security, environmental security, economic security, you overlap those three areas. What do you see at the intersection, at the nexus of all three challenges?
Energy.
Energy security, precisely. Energy security is at the core of all of these challenges, and that's precisely what I'm really honored to share with you, because particularly this Senate committee is exactly the colleagues and audience that this is exactly what your leadership impacts. And also, these energy crises have taught us interdependencies. Looking at the whole system and then choosing what areas are the biggest pinch points and what can we do together to relieve those pinch points judiciously in a cost-effective way. So when we look at this, is a busy slide, and I apologize that portion of it gets trimmed because of the LCD projector. But on your left-hand side, you're seeing all the energy input into United States, into our system, everything we use. From about 40% comes from petroleum, 22% from natural gas, 23% from coal, 8% from nuclear, 0.6% from solar, wind is 0.15%, geothermal, biomass, hydro. This is the input. Now what you're seeing throughout this slide is what do we do with it? How much of it is used for transportation, light duty vehicles, freight, aircraft, and then how much goes to industry, how much to commercial, residential? When you look at the right-hand side of it, on the other side, you're going to see one part which is all gray. That is wasted energy, the energy system that is inefficient. How much do you think is the overall system efficiencies for our total energy flow, even before we get to the last mile? In this slide, you will see that we lose about 56% of our energy even before we get to the last mile. The system, overall system efficiency is only about 44%, or end to end. So the challenge is, what do we do? What do we shift? And also, if we talk about imported oil and other sources, what do we substitute for in order to enable a more efficient, a more homegrown, economically viable, national security challenges and environmentally sound area in this substitution? Incidentally, the biggest source of loss is transportation. 29.5% of the fuels that go into transportation are wasted. Electricity, my area, loses about 25.5%. But the biggest sources of loss in electricity, I will come back to transportation, but what do you think is the source? What is the efficiency of most cars we drive? I'm an engineer. I have a muscle car. It has 384 horsepower. Maybe it's getting old. It's 380 and a couple of donkeys. But this car has only a 14% well-to-wheel kind of efficiency. 14%. Loses 86% of the fuel put into it. Most cars have an efficiency of 13 to 18%. How about the electricity, end-to-end? I will show you a picture. For electricity, this is mapped out for the whole thing. Just take, for example, coal. Efficiency of coal power plant is about 35, at best 40%. Transmission, the grid, the high voltage transmission, doesn't lose much. It only loses about 7 to 8%. But the end use, when we get to homes, businesses, factories, the efficiency can improve quite a bit. Efficiency of the light bulb, original light bulb, even the things we used up to a few years ago, has an efficiency of about 7%. So when you take the efficiency of the power plant, which is 35%, multiply it by 92%, which is for the grid and transmission distribution, by the light at the end, the total system efficiency we get is 1.6%. 98.4% is wasted. By putting more advanced lighting, such as light-emitting diodes, LED lighting, and so on, we improve this by about 10 times. What it does, it can bring up the total system efficiency to about 16 to 18%. But we still have a long way to go. That's one overall system efficiency which end-to-end needs to be remedied. So to share with you the recommendations that I made to the Congress last March and last October, in a nutshell, these are my four recommendations that I had the privilege of making on behalf of American Society of Mechanical Engineers, ASME, and Institute of Electrical Electronics Engineers, IEEE. First one is build a stronger, smarter power grid. And in doing that, transform the network into smart so that you're using not only your resources more efficiently, also there is a security dimension, there is a cybersecurity as well as natural disasters and other stressors that we can counteract. Second one, as you will notice, we have been operating the system, this North American grid, and also in our region with closer and closer margins for incorporating new sources of generation into it. So we need to make the system a lot stronger and expand the capacity on it. Develop massive storage, because in order to allow for intermittent sources, we need massive storage. Incidentally, Mr. Suford, Will has the my presentation. The presentation that you have in front of you, I apologize, it may be a little bit small, hard to see. So we will be happy to send you the full version. And Will, I sent you a shorter version for distribution to our distinguished senators. The second part connected to this is electrification of transportation. By incorporating, and I'm going to get more into this, into plug-in hybrid vehicles, as well as develop and use alternative transportation fuels to help in part substitute for oil, for imported oil. Third recommendation is green the electric power supply. Expand the use of renewables, expand the use of advanced, more modern nuclear power generation, and capture carbon. We have demonstrated for CO2 capture. We have shown for mid-size coal power plants we can do that. Except whenever you do carbon capture, you lose about 30% of the efficiency, 30%. So when the companies who put such carbon capture and sequestration in place, they need to have a way to recover the 30% revenue lost from incorporating environmentally sound, environmentally friendly technologies. Also, demonstration of this in large-scale power plant needs to be done. Finally, the first message we started, increasing the system efficiency, you saw the losses. So to step back and look at the technologies and where the resources are, it may help to just step back and say where in the US or in North America supply is, where the demands are, and what is the best way to connect the two together. So in this one, it may be difficult to see, but the shaded gray areas are where the resources are. Oil, sand, natural gas, wind, coal, wind, wind, coal, nuclear in the southeast, renewables in Southern California. The red dots that you may have a hard time seeing are the population growth areas. What is the most efficient way to capture and transfer energy? After all, electrons are just an energy carrier. Hydrogen is an energy carrier. Conversion of, let's say, fossil fuels into chemicals, ammonia, other things, is also an energy carrier. What do you think is the most efficient, the best energy carrier among all the alternatives? Electrons. Electrons, by far, are the number one most efficient, cleanest, and most efficient energy carrier there is, period. It's cheaper, it's more efficient to transfer energy, capture, use, transfer those electrons than if you turn it into fuel and send the fuel either by rail, by trucks, or by pipelines. So the direction of the blue arrows shows which direction we need to have energy flowing, from capturing to flowing to the sources, population growth centers. So this gives us insight into what superhighways we need to develop and retrofit the existing system. It gets to the stronger portion of the grid. In the background of this picture, you're seeing the North American grid. And as you know, there are three major subsystems. Everything east of the Rockies, everything, including portions of Canada all the way down to Texas, are part of one interconnected system called Eastern Interconnection. So everything has to work with the same frequency at 60 hertz simultaneously. So if massive, let's say, demand grows all of a sudden in one place, generators, some places are going to go a little bit faster to generate electrons to meet that demand. Everything to the west of the Rockies, all the 11 western states in the United States and two Canadian provinces and a tiny bit of Texas are the western grid. And Texas has a grid of its own called ERCOT, Electricity Reliability Council of Texas. So those are the three interconnections. In the background, you're seeing green, other colleagues. That's the existing North American grid. It's a marvel of engineering. National Academy of Engineering selected it as the number one greatest achievement of engineering in the 20th century because it underpins our economy, our quality of life, everything we do in America, everything. The maroon part is what Department of Energy, Electric Power Research Institute, where I worked before coming to University of Minnesota 7 years ago, and several utilities, including American Electric Power, that operates in 18 states, have mapped out. What do we need to retrofit the existing grid into preparing it to meet the kind of transfer, power transfer, we need to do from here to the population centers? So this grid, the maroon part, is retrofitted on top of the existing one. The cost of building this is about $82 billion. The cost of outages per year to our economy are over $100 billion per year. And I will show you other data statistics later on that this is a cost-effective way to do it and must be done. So this is the stronger part of the grid. Make the grid stronger by augmenting it, strengthening it by these high-voltage DC, actually. They are high-voltage DC, so the system becomes also more controllable and less lossy. To make it smarter, in June of 2008, a reporter from Nature magazine came to my office at the U, and I did some drawing on a whiteboard. Their graphic artist took it and did a much better job than I could have ever done. So this is thanks to the graphic artist. In a nutshell, think of this as St. Paul. Think of it as Minneapolis, or think of it as University of Minnesota campus. Every building has building-integrated solar panels. City of Malmo in Sweden is further up north than we are. And guess what we did? Malmo was the dirtiest city in Sweden. They had a strategic plan that in 10 years they wanted to become among the top two cleanest cities in Sweden. In 7 years, they made it happen. How? They put building-integrated wind generators, not the big windmills, but the kind that looks like a DNA helix, to capture the wind. They also put solar panels. They have buildings with storage, battery even with compressed air. And also another thing they did, they planted trees. They made the streets smaller so you couldn't drive big cars through those streets. They actually, you have to either walk or have a small electric vehicle going up. In 7 years, Malmo, M-A-L-M-O, became the cleanest city in Sweden. And it's almost at the same level as Hudson Bay. So the vision in part is that. The other part is smart appliances. Imagine if your air conditioner, your heater, your refrigerator, your dishwasher all have a smart chip in them, securely, with security built in. They help you. You put a budget. My budget for, let's say, this week is $20. You put your budget in. These little chips, they negotiate with each other how you're going to run based on your use of how much you wash the clothes and so on. Learn from your behavior without making it hard for you. Nothing like the old VCRs. Nobody wants to program VCRs or these devices. But these devices communicate. They do a distributed optimization to help you with managing your resources better. And also build security built in. Retrofitting the existing generation. We have about $1 trillion investment into the infrastructure in the United States. About $400 billion of it is in transmission. A lot of it is in the generation assets. Retrofitting that from small generators to large ones, central power plants, to become more efficient and integrated in that seamless way. So in summary, my recommendations to the Congress have been integrate distributed, dispersed renewable system, but in order to connect them together, we need a modernized grid, a modernized transmission system that is smarter and is stronger. And that would also enable the capabilities we are seeing also for electrification of transportation. These are the four initiatives. Each one of them had several programs in it, which I had the privilege of developing when I worked for the think tank for all the utilities called Electric Power Research Institute in Palo Alto. The grandfather, grandmother of Smart Grid was this program on complex interactive networks that I provided 58% of the funding. Department of Defense, Deputy Undersecretary for Science and Engineering, provided about 42% of funding to 28 universities, including University of Minnesota. And we had 106 professors, 108 professors working on understanding and managing layers after layer of infrastructure. Fuel supply, on top of it put electric power networks, transportation, financial systems, and on top of all that, cyber and communication networks. How do these systems hang together? How do disturbances propagate in them? So we did that 12 years ago, 11 years ago, and the notion of self-healing grid, smart grid, was one of the 24 technologies we extracted out of it. On the tragic day of September 11th, I was in Washington, D.C., less than actually a mile from Pentagon, briefing the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy on how to detect precursors to failure and how to save such large-scale systems on this initiative. Then because of this work, I had the privilege of directing all the utility security R&D after 9/11. So 4 days later, when I got back to California, I inherited what was the Y2K program and updated it, and we developed our private sector response to 9/11 tragedies. And these are some of the highlights, which I won't take too much of your time, but I'm at your service to talk about security as well as smart grid if needed. And then the IntelliGrid, self-healing grid that led to smart grid came out of the latter program. This was the origin that you're seeing here, who was involved, 108 professors, 240 grad students, 52 utilities, and others. To get more forward, the whole evolution of this has been 12 to 20 years in the making, the whole idea behind smart grid. If we look back into the communication network that is needed, was done in the 1990s, and the communication architecture, then one of my initiatives, and so on. And at the Department of Energy side, from 2003-2004, the Modern Grid Initiative and GridWise, and now NIST has the architecture and standards that need to go to for devices to talk to each other. So the smart grid in a nutshell, this is the definition I've been using for about 12 years, is the layer of communication control, sensing, that operates on top in conjunction with the electric power system end-to-end to enable it, minimizing the cost to consumers, improving security, quality, resilience, and to facilitate interconnection of new sources, almost like USB devices. Remember 10 years ago we had to install software for USB to run? We don't do that anymore. We just plug and play. Can we do that with electric power systems? With our plug-in electric vehicles, so when you plug it in, it's smart, knows what's going on, and can store or sell power back to the distribution system. So there are a range of possibilities that I had put functionalities on the board back 12 years ago, managing integration of distributed generators, renewable sources, microgrids, use and management of these systems as an integrated, secure, intelligent network, and ensuring that business strategies for a deregulated energy markets cannot be gamed, has transparency. So Enron, this was before Enron, organizations such as Enron cannot game the system. There are more recently, these are smart grid basically definitions. This is from Department of Energy, two-way power and information flow, enabling clean, renewable energy, decarbonized power, effective demand management. There are many more. In Canada, there is more. Department of Energy has a nice 2008 report called Smart Grid and Introduction. There are many definitions. I share with you about five of them. Ms. Georgie Hilker from the Minnesota, the Office of Energy Security, asked me about 2 weeks ago on behalf of Commissioner Bill Glahn and the colleagues, what is Smart Grid? So I dug and I found it's not just Masoud Amin 12 years ago saying something, but there is a lot in that area that is going on. But most of them define it in terms of functionality. What are the technologies under that? What are the reliability and what is the efficiency? That's what really what when we look at these definitions, what comes out of it. Also, DOE's summary in terms of functionalities are these areas in terms of reconfigurable smart system, enabling active participation by consumers in demand response, leveling their demand, if you will, operating resiliently against physical and cyber attacks, providing quality that our digital devices, what we call power quality for a digital society requires, and then enabling new products and services. So when you look at all these, it's a highly instrumented system. It's almost like you take Wright Brothers aircraft and you put new avionics, new wings into that, and you upgrade something that used to fly but make it a lot more agile, a lot more robust, and a lot more resilient. So compare, I would say, 1960s aircraft to today's fighter planes. That's the transformation we're talking about at a cost we can afford. So these are the population growth areas, nodes. We are connecting them by communication fabric that reaches every device with security and privacy built in. And basically the four areas that are the goal of it, the vision for it is engage the customers, enhance efficiency and reliability, and enable renewable integration electric transportation. What's going on outside? At Electric Power Research Institute, you saw the chart for the last 20 years from utility communication architecture, complex network, and other areas. There are many initiatives. Excel, as you know, in Boulder, Colorado, you saw the presentation last year. Randy or another colleague from Excel may have briefed you on that. AEP American Electric Power, Austin Energy in Texas at the state capital has a very progressive CIO, Andres Carvalho, and what he has done, he comes from telecom background. He has already, what I like about it, he has implemented Smart Grid 1.0, which is all the way from power plant, transmission, distribution, meter, customer information, billing, and back and forth. They already did it by August of 2009 for 1 million consumers, 43,000 businesses, and 440 square miles. They have 500,000 devices in there. Right now what they're working on is integration of smart appliances and also electric hybrid vehicles integrated transportation. I would love to see something like this done for St. Paul or for basically Minneapolis or Rochester or Duluth. Start with a pilot. And we can show something like this in Minnesota, learn from the experiences. It's great, actually, that we are not the trailblazers. We can learn from what they did, and we can become settlers and do this in a way which is cost-effective and works for Minnesota. There are many organizations in California, as you know, there are incentives to put these smart meters, and smart meters are just one node, just one piece of it. But Southern California, Pacific Gas and Electric, also in Florida, similarly, Baltimore, many involved. Many companies, including some of our own companies in Minnesota, Honeywell, IBM in Rochester, Conexus Energy here in Minnesota, Great River to some extent, are involved in this type of effort in addition to Excel. So what is going on in terms of leaders? I have mapped out here, as of September of last year, what are smart grid demonstrations? Who is doing what? In Minnesota, we can do a lot more than we are doing. That's why I'm really grateful for this opportunity to share with you what's going on nationally and what we can do together. This may be hard to see, but here is end-to-end smart grid opportunities, all the way from foundations managing assets better, whether they're at home or at a utility or at a building or at a commercial industrial sector, IT infrastructure, enterprise IT, we need for it, telecommunication, circuit topology of what distribution systems are. But what I like about this diagram from British Columbia Hydro, BC Hydro, is the yellow part is customer side, basically application. Blue is the utility side. Smart meters have both. Meter data management is mostly utility, distribution automation. Each one of them is mapped out, what can be done, and why this would be this fundamental application, and what value added on top of it we can use. As an analogy, think about telephone. 30 years ago, how much did we pay AT&T? What services we had back then? How much are you paying today? And what services do you have today? So that's the kind of transformation we like to do in a way which is not only sustainable, but is going to create services for consumers and create jobs and technologies in Minnesota. So along that lines, my office, where I just came from with my colleagues, is at the building at the University of Minnesota on the corner of 35W Bridge and Washington Avenue. My office is on the fifth floor. My office faces I-35W Bridge. On August 1st, 2007, I witnessed the collapse of 35W Bridge. So I went down there, and out of that tragic day, I'm really pleased that several of our alumni of our Master of Science on Infrastructure Systems Engineering who work for MnDOT or work for City of Minneapolis, they developed sensors built in into the new bridge. And these sensors cost less than 0.5% of total cost. What do they enable? A smarter bridge in the sense that stresses, chemical changes, loads on the bridge can be sensed fast and in real time, so that the kind of collapse that we saw will never happen again. That's the kind of built-in intelligence we would love to see develop as part of smart grid for our state, for our cities and state and the nation, at a cost we can afford. The key point is 0.5% of total cost enabled these sensors on the I-35W. These sensors are going to create a tsunami of information. This is showing you today in terms of terabytes of information going through the system. In the next 3 years, a tsunami of data may develop if we incorporate these sensors. We're going to get about 10-fold increase in data. So building security and having the ability to handle large volumes of data becomes critical. Fortunately, in Minnesota, we have been a leader in this area when it comes to handling large volumes of data. Our colleagues in IBM in Rochester, when they see 800 terabytes, they have that for appetizer. They have that for breakfast. They can handle a lot more than this, but we need to bring them to the table and get them, if you will, engaged. And this can be another area. Honeywell. Honeywell has been a pioneer in this area when it comes to building automation and handling all the way, whether from chemical process controls, building automation, data that is coming in. So there is quite a bit of brain power. At the University of Minnesota, my colleagues and I, there is a lot of not only interest, but almost a passion to see this happen, to help this happen in Minnesota. So in a nutshell, the core of the smart grid is this part, is the communication enabling of the entire end-to-end system from transmission, substation, distribution to consumers, prices to devices, if you will, to the everything we connect to it, whether they're building integrated panels, whether they're electric cars, whether they're devices used for monitoring, this exchange of seamless information across the enterprise. To step back, the foresight for this is what's going on in renewables, infrastructure upgrade, and electrification of transportation. I just share with you two slides on that. The same barrel of oil, same barrel, going through a refinery, which has 84% basically efficiency, going through hoping there is no leak in the transport and to the gas station, gives you about 1,231 miles per British thermal unit. So it gives you about, per barrel of oil, you get about 1,230 miles. Use the same barrel of oil, put it through the same old inefficient power generation that has an efficiency of 31 to 50%. Put that electron through the grid and distribution system that reduces the efficiency a little bit more. Put it in a plug-in hybrid. Instead of 1,230 miles, you're going to get 1,600 to 2,100 miles from the same barrel of oil. So electrons become the energy carrier of choice. This is using today's lithium-ion batteries, not a future battery technology. It's today. But in order to make this happen, we need the grid to be strengthened and made smarter. Another part, because we have Senator Carlson, who is a mechanical engineer, this part I included it just to show you what happens in this whole part. Gas tank hopefully is not leaky. Internal combustion engine has an efficiency of 15 to 20%. Transmission, 90 to 95%. Drivetrain, 95% efficiency. If you multiply all these three, gasoline engine gives you an efficiency of 13 to 18%. My muscle car is on the lower end of it, 14% efficiency. If you replace that by battery, as long as the electrons are coming from a cleaner source, from a better source for this, and you have the transmission to handle it, batteries today technology has an efficiency 85 to 90. Motor, and replace this, electric vehicle will go from, instead of 13 to 18%, would go to 62 to 77% efficiency. That's for the transportation part. Now, coming back where we are today and why we need to take action, if you look at the National Academy of Engineering's assessment of greatest achievement of engineering in 20th century, the gentleman who led that Blue Ribbon Commission was the first human being who ever walked on the moon. So when he was appointed, I said, oh, it's a done deal. They're going to select man walking on the moon as the greatest achievement. But you know what they selected? Networks of electrification. The North American power grid. It's the greatest achievement. It's the largest machine in the world. It connects, underpins our economy, our quality of life. That's what they selected. However, this greatest achievement is being operated under strain and stress. And to show you data, this data is a little bit busy, so I will go through it with you a little bit, take the time to discuss what it is. On your left-hand side, you're seeing the top 10 sectors of industry, how much they invest in research and development as percentage of net sales. So engineering and management services, computers, pharmaceuticals, communication equipment invest anywhere from 6.5% to 13% of net sales back into innovation in research and development. I took the middle part out. This is the data from 95 to 2000. And I will share with you the more recent version. The middle part is out. These are the bottom 20. When you look at this picture, where would you have expected electricity to be? When we know that everything here depends on reliable electrons, reliable electricity. Unfortunately, it's the second from the bottom. It's grouped together with gas and sanitation services. We invested less than 0.3%, less than 1/3%, as opposed to 12 or 13%, less than 1/3% into research and development in this sector. It's only lower than railroads, it's only higher than railroads and building materials. This situation, would you have expected this to have improved or worsened in the 5 years after this, 6 years after this? Unfortunately, it's gotten worse. But before I show you that, it's gotten so much worse that pet food industry spends more dollar-wise and percentage-wise in research and development. Here it is, hot off the press. This is up to the part I showed you, up to 2000. It has dropped from 0.3 to 0.17, less than 0.2% of net sales goes into research and development in the electricity sector. There is only now one sector that spends less, and it's pulp and paper industry. So we need, in this area, quite a bit of change to bring innovation into it. If we look at the history of North American grid, this is from 1925, rural electrification. How much has been invested in infrastructure, capital invested, as a percentage of the revenue? Gray is generation, all the generators in North America. Blue is the high voltage transmission, is the grid, and maroon is the last part, which is the distribution. The boom bust cycles you're seeing have been toward the decline. This is California. Most of that was gas-fired plants that people thought if they build it, they can sell it, but that depended on transmission that was almost choked most of the time, so the generators could not participate and the system could be gamed. When you look at the over-harvesting that has taken place, milking the cow dry, I'd like to share with you the depreciation amortization to the pretty much that crossed over in 1995. It crossed over construction building expenditure. We may say, well, it's a mature industry, it doesn't have to build more, but we look at all the indices in terms of how much capacity we have, how much shock absorption we have, how many corridors are blocked. We need more transmission. There are many choke points across the country. And I analyzed the outages. The outages in the first half of 1990s, second half of 1990s, and the outages, these are major, large outages that have affected our nation. There were 66 major outages in the first half of 1990s that affecting millions of customers. The second half of the decade, it grew from 66 to 76. In the first part of this decade, it has moved from 76 to 140. So they are on the rise. And what's the toll, what's the cost to our economy? These outages cost our economy over $100 billion. Exact number depends on how bad of a year it is. It's between $119 billion per year to over $180 billion per year. Who is doing more in this area? This is showing you how many millions of dollars of investment per gigawatts per year goes into New Zealand, England, Denmark, Spain, other nations who have even privatized, deregulated their power, they spend on it. They spend $22 million per gigawatt per year. They spend the various numbers. And the other part, which is important to note, how many responsible parties are there owning the transmission? We may say, we are engineers. When we did this for IEEE Power and Energy Society, we said, well, wait a second. New Zealand is an emerging economy. They are supposed to spend more on infrastructure. Then we said, what about England, Denmark, Spain, Netherlands, Norway? And then we said, wait a second, they're too small. We're much bigger. But think of each one of them as a region within our nation. Each one of them being one part, one region within North America. So North American grid is underinvested, as you have seen, and it's a complex set of ownership. Having the, not to take over it, but having incentives that would for them to work together to bring up the system. Sure. because we are connected. Many of these 450 organizations, one choke point affects others. It's almost like water flowing pipes. If we all turn our lawn watering system on, water pressure drops for everybody. It's the same thing. And my hat is off. They keep the system up under stress and strain, but a lot more needs to be done.
Dr. Amin, have you any, can you venture a rationale for why that underinvestment occurs?
I have four areas. One is the lack of innovation, incentives to actually do innovation in this sector. And I can share with you in my publications an assessment, not just mine, but other colleagues, why that innovation has been killed in this area. Second one, we have a system that works most of the time. On any given day, we only have about 500,000 people without electricity for 2 hours or more in the United States. But fortunately, there are not the same half a million people. Otherwise, it would be Groundhog Day. We would do something about it. Third one is regulatory. Regulatory, in your domain of expertise, the state rights versus federal rights, who does what, whether it's the public utility commissioners do it, whether it is FERC that does it, the rules have not been clearly, it's almost like a patchwork. There is not a unified national framework to handle all these system upgrades across many states. And on that note, I would be happy if you like to share more material on the regulatory with you in that domain. That part needs to be done, and it's a public-private partnership that would enable it. Because the private sector by itself is not doing it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And so I would appreciate if you could...
Wrap up.
No.
This
is very interesting. But if you do forward some ideas to me about the... clarifying the regulatory rules.
I'd be delighted to. About security, there
Dr.
are...
Dr. Amin, just a minute.
Senator, yes, please.
Dibble?
Thanks. This kind of reminds me of our rate-setting conversation that we had. And I've had these conversations with the utilities in my office as well, and we've had them around this table, and that's, to the doctor's point, we ask the utilities in a regulated environment to deliver us power as cheaply as possible. And we don't make a lot of space available to them for this kind of R&D and innovation and that sort of thing. And it's something we really do have to kind of figure out and grapple with. I think a very compelling point has been made when we realize that we're paying in lack of reliability, $100 billion in our economy. That's pretty surprising. So maybe there's a way we can internalize that dollar, convert those dollars lost into dollars we spend on innovation and R&D.
Yeah, and if you have ideas on how to improve efficiency also.
I'd be delighted to. I agree with Senator Dibble. That's exactly the point. Even if it is 1% of net sales, 1%, we are not asking for 12%, 13%. Even if it is 1% of net sales that goes into not sometimes also funny math can be used to account for it. So if there's transparency and collaboration in making it happen would be very timely, would go a long way. About security, as you have noticed, dogs, guards, cameras, and guns protected us for centuries, for decades. While that is still necessary, but it's insufficient. Why? Because we have systems of bewildering complexity, connectivity, that have grown all the way from our micro devices to the massive infrastructures we depend on. So there is a new spectrum of threat that we traditionally did not prepare ourselves for, ranging from cyber threats to also the complexity of this system and the fact that many of these infrastructures are interconnected in ways that we would have not envisioned when we designed them. So when you look at this, Dr. Ron Ross, who leads the computer security for the power grid at NIST, he was here about 3 months ago, and he gave a great presentation about the threat situation. What are the cyber threats on our information systems, whether they're private sector or federal, state, local, and private sectors? And these attacks are increasingly more organized. Last summer, an attack that originated from China went through North Korea, and they hide their footprint, so it's not very easy to do forensics. And they penetrated our critical systems. Just from Pentagon, some of these attacks have stolen terabytes, megabytes, gigabytes, terabytes of data and information. They're not necessarily trying to shut things down, but they're stealing intellectual capital, designs, and intellectual property. So if from an economic security point of view, this has long-term and short-term ramifications for our security. The adversaries, many of them are no longer just a teenager thrill-seeker wanting to prove they can do it, but they are nation-states that have trained. Reverse engineering, hacking, ability to hack is part of the curriculum of the senior year in computer science and computer engineering, electrical engineering in Russia and in China. People are trained to hack and reverse engineer system. Reverse engineering, why they take our designs, you can give them this laptop and they can reverse engineer it and sell it with much less price, could be is sold back to us under a different brand name. And I don't mean it in a xenophobic way. You notice my own northern Minnesota accent.
Yeah.
So it is not to be xenophobic, but these are real threats to our economy and our quality of life. These are some quotations from Hamdoun Touré, which is the consortium that is all the information technology units are involved. This is from Hamdoun. It can be as part of a multi-pronged attack on our nation. The other one is from former Director of National Intelligence, Mike McConnell, that we are the most vulnerable nation. Why? Because we have the lion's share of the assets. We have about 46% of all the IT, information technology assets of the world. And we are big. So others are after, if you will, after us to try to penetrate it. And they're the most dependent on information technology. Commissioner Gopal Khanna and I have worked on this for the last 2 years on many dimensions of it. And Commissioner Khanna has two very nice pieces recently that came out in exactly in this area, how to secure, especially for state government, how to secure that. Amit Yoran was the first director of cybersecurity at the Department of Homeland Security. And this is what Amit says about what's going on. So what is at risk? All the areas that you're seeing, federal information system, state and local information system, private sector, and our infrastructure, our critical infrastructure. Department of Homeland Security designates 18 infrastructure as critical to our security. And these are some of them. So this is the data that I shared with you. What do we own in North America, and the number of documented attacks, and the cost of each one of these attacks is from $500 million to over $10 billion per successful attack, as you're seeing documented. I intentionally shared some of the older ones that are well known, well documented. We know exactly what the cost is in each one of them. So in order to enable the smart infrastructure means we are going to rely even more on information technology. That it means that what it means is that we need to build security as fundamental, built in within these systems. Otherwise, it's the Achilles heel. We are enabling by putting more IT, more sensors, more communication into these smart devices. We are gonna, if we don't do it right, we are gonna end up opening new sets of vulnerabilities. These are some examples. I decided to show you some candies that are out there. All the way from smart power strip, Google's power meter. In other states, such as California, Florida, talking about one policy area, you can actually see, you can monitor your home energy use on your device. You can get access to the Google power meter to see what's going on. Smart meters, inside of them, they have antenna, they have chips built in. This is the IBM, what IBM does, which is a smart device similar to, remember the old Honeywell devices, the thermostats? This is the modern-day IT-intensive version of it. Baltimore Gas and Electric has a globe. In my old organization at EPRI, we had a bunny that the color of the bunny would change depending on what the price of electricity was and how much we were using. It was small bunny. So there are many ways to do it, even get kids in school interested in this and use it. What's the price, what footprint we put, and so on. Imagine in your house you had a dashboard that would show all the things that were going on. Best Buy is selling this device. And I like what GE shows. GE says all of these, you want to be able to plug into all these resources and in a way that provides true smart network. And the part on the security side, on the data transmission and networking and device security, there's quite a bit of work underway to enable it. What we are doing at the U, on areas that we are doing, Professor Bruce Wallenberg, who is a member of National Academy of Engineering, he's also a full professor in electrical and computer engineering. We have a group that before Smart Grid was a common name, 6 years ago, we created a center for smart grid technologies. So some of the areas we have worked on, and our PhD students, Anthony Giacomoni, Lori Miller, Sarah Mullen, homegrown Minnesotans, these are the areas. So the part about plug-in electric vehicles is smart vehicles that can negotiate, charge up when the electricity is abundant, and use the car as a battery and sell it back, use it as a small generator. So your house, your car, is making you money. Sarah did her doctoral dissertation on that, intelligent chips, intelligent devices, and she got her doctorate back in September. Now she works for my old colleagues in Electric Power Research Institute. These two areas, currently, when we do risk assessment, security monitoring of the grid, there are about 120 control centers across our nation that get the data from substation, from the field. They bring it in. By the time they bring it in and analyze it, it takes 30 to 32 seconds to analyze it. So it's as if you're driving a car. Instead of looking ahead, you're looking through your rearview mirror at the 32 seconds ago. What we did, we are using gaming computers. And we have unleashed the power of a bright Minnesotan, Lori Miller, on the gaming machines, these fast chips. Instead of using the gaming chips for gaming, we're using it with some sophisticated algorithms, mathematical algorithms, to do fast risk assessment. In that project, we are getting 12 times speed up. Instead of 30 seconds, we are doing it in less than 3 seconds, in 2.5 seconds. What's the security of the system? Because if you're going to put smart devices in it, you got to know what the security is and so on. Similarly, we are expanding it to also cyber physical for the smart grid. In addition to that, I had a proposal last summer, and I'm delighted to partner with many colleagues from Minnesota, the Office of Energy Security, Bill, Georgie, Betsy, as well as the other colleagues across the industry, Honeywell, IBM, other organizations, Conexus Energy. We made a proposal to the Department of Energy as part of their ARPA-E, which is the Advanced Research Projects Agency energy portion, similar to DARPA for defense. DOE has created an ARPA-E. And we proposed to them to use University of Minnesota East Campus as a pilot to make it into smart grid. We call it Smart Grid U. Smart Grid U, to have system models, algorithms, tools to integrate all of these systems within a microgrid, do wind tunnel testing of smart grid designs, policies, reduce cost, and make the system more resilient, and have a net zero, zero carbon footprint into the system. We had also colleagues from Initiative for Renewable Energy and Environment, IRE, that many of you know, they do an outstanding job to partner with us in this. So the good news is we got a great team together, a dream team. The bad news is idea wasn't revolutionary enough for ARPA-E. They told us it's great, and we were going to use this, show it in Minnesota and replicate it elsewhere. But we haven't given up on it. We're persisting, and we hope to get to do it, because this, what we have learned so far from this holistic systems approach, focus on benefits to cost, payback out of it, what benefit in terms of cost, and what are the deficiencies, using also university as a living laboratory, and bringing both young undergraduates all the way to research to implement new solutions. This is what we hope to do. We haven't had a funder yet from DOE. In addition to that, since about a year ago, in partnership with the University of Minnesota's Institute of Technology, Office of Energy Security, IRE, and Dick is here actually from IRE, my colleague in that, Rod Larkins and other colleagues, we have had 3 Minnesota Smart Grid Coalition building workshops. The first one was on July 8th. We had over 100 participants. What's the status of it? What we can do? The second one, and I'm very grateful to Commissioner Bill Glant, Georgie Hilker, who helped a lot, their office and them helped a lot of these, and to IRE that used a third day of the Renewable Energy and Environment E3 Summit to focus on three areas: energy and cybersecurity, energy efficiency, and integration of renewables. There were about 160 participants. From these, we boiled it down to last week. We had a small group, and we focused on what we can do for Minnesota and what are the areas we can do. So in a nutshell, this is our objective. Position Minnesota as a leader in the development and deployment of smart grid technologies and products. Our action plan is these four areas. What are the smart grid unique opportunities in Minnesota? Discover our competitive advantage in this market. Position Minnesota to take the lead nationally and regionally and develop a value proposition, a business case, if you will, and economic benefits to key stakeholders. So there are the next steps. We have five teams. Each one is very lean, focused with a clear mission and mandate to what these are. Portfolio for Minnesota smart grid capabilities, articulate to the stakeholders what it is we are doing, why we need to do it, flesh out the transmission utility customer model, and develop state regulatory model to support this market. And then the kinds of smart grid pilot projects that will be necessary to do. So some of the colleagues on there you may recognize. We are pleased to have them. Getting to the policy, these are the questions that we posed as our last workshop. What's the opportunity in Minnesota? What's the competitive advantage that we have? We have a lot of brain power. We were number one in IT 30 years ago. We have all the way from some of the organizations I mentioned, Honeywell, 3M, Cargill, that can be players in this area, IBM and so on, as well as the University of Minnesota, and having a supportive public policy to make this happen. And as actually we are very rich in terms of different renewable sources, different sources that are available within the state. And then positioning us to lead the way, to take the lead, and what's our game plan? What's the value proposition for that? So all of these were areas we explored. That was local. Federal, this is a busy slide, but this is basically direct spending in the last year. What passed the Congress? Renewable energy, grid deployment, smart grid is about $3.4 billion explicitly for smart grid, and other areas all the way to advanced batteries and so on. In terms of tax incentives, this is the production tax credit, investment tax credit, which is to all renewable resources, advanced energy manufacturing credits, $2 billion for manufacturing investments, and then plug-in electric drive vehicle credit. So this is the summary of all the areas from spending to tax incentives that are out there. To conclude, engagement of consumers is critical to a successful policy implementation to enable this end-to-end system modernization. If this transformation is to be successful, we need to seamlessly integrate this system and to enable every building, every node, including where we are today, to be an efficient, smart node within this infrastructure. And basically, the range of new services, basically don't think of it, please, as smart grid as a means to an end. It's not an end unto itself. It is what services does it provide. Think about AT&T, how much we paid, what services we got 30 years ago. Think about today. What do we expect our infrastructure for the next 10, 20, 30 years to do for us? What's, in a sense, what services we need? And then what is the underpinning fundamental infrastructure to enable that? As you know, this is the map of Xcel's areas. We have highly available renewables into the system. So that's going back to the first part. These are the areas that you probably have already seen, areas that we need more transmission. especially for not only bring electrons where it is needed, but also what are the integration of some of these sources all the way from hydro to renewables. That was the overall picture, and I wanted to conclude by what is beyond energy that I have done the assessment at our institute at the university to share with you briefly. The institute that I have the privilege of directing, Technological Leadership Institute, was established 23 years ago to develop local global leaders for technology enterprises. We have three Master of Science degrees. Our Management of Technology, which is the flagship, is the oldest such program at a public university in the U.S., has been very successful. I will show you what our alumni do. Infrastructure Systems Engineering, that a lot of the colleagues who were involved in the reconstruction of the 35W bridge are alumni of this program. And our newest one, the security part, which I shared with you, we developed a program to counteract, to prepare people in 14 months as they're working full-time with a Master of Science in security, whether it is power grid, cyber, food supply, pandemics, and their colleagues from policy area. We have partnership. We bring creme de la creme of faculty from 8 colleges at the U to teach in our programs. We also have shorter courses that take that DNA and apply it from across the university areas, from Humphrey for policy, from Carlson School for business, engineering and applied science, from Institute of Technology, intellectual property protection, from law school. And in-house, we have 5 endowed chairs, thanks to Honeywell and Gemini Foundation, that do the core areas of what we do. So we leverage the 5 endowed chairs with 47 faculty from across the university, government and business leaders who teach in our programs. So for us, technology is any application of science. It's not just hardware or software, and we look end-to-end. And these are some of the areas that we work on: gene therapy, biotech, pharmaceuticals, security and privacy technologies, fuel cells, composites, nanotechnology for biomedical and energy applications. Who are our students? They're all working professionals in Minnesota. Many of them are employed by the companies in the Twin Cities areas. Average age is 36 years old. So as they're working full-time, as they have family full-time, one day a week they come to class, alternating Fridays and Saturdays. These are their expertise. These are their job titles. And what is really, I think, a good measure of their success is this is before they go through Master of Science in Management of Technology. In 21 months, they do the degree at the U in our center. This is the positions they hold. Please look at what they do 5 to 8 years later. 27% become executives of Minnesota companies. 42% move into management. And the other areas, there are some diehard R&D folks who don't want to move into management. They prefer to remain in R&D. So in a nutshell, out of about 30 a year, we limit the class size to only about 30 a year because we focus on each individual. Out of 531, over 33% of them are executives in Minnesota companies. And over 50% of the remaining alumni are managers or management duties. This is an engine for economic growth. How? Many colleagues, many distinguished senators and colleagues in the room know that the Institute of Technology at the U is our College of Engineering, Physical Sciences, Physics, Chemistry, Geology, Astronomy, Geophysics, and Mathematics. In 2005, there was a survey of all the alumni, living alumni of the companies they founded, and how many people they employ. 15,000 alumni responded, 3,000 have founded one or more companies, 2,600 active companies in Minnesota alone, just from alumni of one college at the U, Institute of Technology. And annual global revenues back 2005 were $90 billion, $46 billion revenue in Minnesota alone, and employing 175,000 people in Minnesota. Many faculty also are involved. We didn't account for that in the startups that faculty are involved. These are the Minnesota's engine, part of the engine for economic growth are the technologies that you're seeing, all the way from taconite before the World War to the pacemaker, thanks to Earl Buchan, an alumnus of my home department, electrical and computer engineering, to the other areas from wine and apple varieties that you're seeing. So we're really delighted to have this. So I did an assessment for our state. What's Minnesota's technological leadership role? I shared with you energy. There is more in IT, medicine, medical devices, agri-technology. We still have very huge potential in modernizing agriculture in Minnesota. Security and the intersection of nano, biological sciences, and information technologies, both for feeder technologies into medical devices, into security, smart little sensors that can detect pathogens, that can detect biochem hazards. We can build those in Minnesota. So these are six areas that when I did the, as part of our work on technological leadership, I assessed for Minnesota come up as winners for us to pursue. In a nutshell, when we look at economic growth, GDP is a function of three variables. GDP is a function of how much we invest in research and development, the physical capital, the infrastructure to do the job, and the human capital to be there to do the job. That's it. So economic growth, GDP, is how fast, how much, and what are the rates of what you put in these, and is also available, affordable energy. This is the basic, that's what the Nobel Prize economist Robert Solow at MIT showed 22 years ago and won the Nobel Prize for it. To step back, looking at impact of societal change and technology, hunter-gatherers basically used hunting and gathering. Drill holes, exhaust the resources, move on to the next one. Agriculture, 5000 BC to about 1850s, pre-industrial revolution, industrial revolution to the 50s. Information revolution hasn't ended. We're in the middle of it. The next big one that has already started is bio-nano, combined with biological and nanotechnologies, combined with information sciences, and ability to produce, make, engineer these chips, and virtual. How many of us are going to be able to have a fully immersed virtual learning that from our home we can have a conference, total immersion with people in Europe, people in Asia? That's coming. Telepresence that you may have seen is just the beginning of such a technology. There is a lot more to come in that area. So in summary of this economic potential, economic impact for technologies, what Professor Solow, who won the Nobel Prize in economics back 22 years ago, showed, over 60% of our economy is driven by technology. So there are many enabling technologies for the future, information technologies, biotechnology, nano robots that assemble, that without having surgery, they can actually assemble. That's far more into the 15, 20 years from now. Energetics, including solar biomass storage, quantum computing. If this ever happens, all of our passwords are wiped out. This can break all of our security. So we got to, this probably is about, at a minimum, 7 to 10 years into the future. Ability, but then you can solve many of the tough problems very quickly. Societal and technological systems, distance learning, immersion, tele-everything, basically, that we can have. Impact of these, all the way from teleworking, these are future trends, shopping at home, web-based, entertainment, and finally, politics. As soon as a candidate talks, they end up, if you will, getting comments in blogs and online. So in summary, the six areas are the ones that I shared with you. Energy, information technology, medicine, agriculture, security, nano IT. All of this requires one thing. Requires, underpinning all this, is an infrastructure to provide electrons. But these electrons need to support not just electric light and refrigeration, but need to support a network digital economy. That's why we need a transformation in our underpinning infrastructure, this energy, electricity infrastructure, to support our economy in the 21st century. And this requires leadership. As Peter Drucker said, there are only three things that happen naturally in organizations: friction, confusion, underperformance. Everything else requires leadership. So my recommendations to the Congress in March and in October were similar to what I recommend to our colleagues in Minnesota, establish smart grid, self-healing infrastructures as a national priority, as a state priority. Authorize increased funding for research and development demonstrations of the smart grid and interdependency R&D. Basically, in Minnesota, can we choose a pilot, a city, a part of a city, to enable demonstration of this and use that as a way to develop technologies, not just showcase, but develop technologies and apply it. Smart Grid U is an idea I had, but doesn't have to be that. It can be Umore Park, it can be City of St. Paul, it can be City of Minneapolis, or Rochester, or Duluth, or one of the cities. And this is not going to be done by the private sector alone, and not by government alone. It needs a public-private partnership to make this happen. There is a broad range of research and development, including end-use efficiency, electrification of transportation, smarter and stronger grid with massive storage. This part is key. I underlined it. Security is fundamental in enabling this transformation. And there are many parts within the cybersecurity that needs to be addressed. So what do I recommend for Minnesota? The key question. We step back, we ask, what are the key energy, environmental, and economic issues facing us? What are the range of new services that smart grid enables? And I humbly suggest to you to include smart grids in all energy legislation, because as you saw, it's not just smart grid for the sake of smart grid, but it's integration of renewables. It is a better, more resilient, more secure system. And potential for smart grid as an enabler in state and federal regulatory policies to drive economic growth. So my takeaway item, if I may suggest, are basically, these are my summary items for your consideration. The vision for this is not new. This is what Wired magazine had said about our work 9 years ago. We want to enable not just light bulbs, but networks of innovation, networks of illumination. And in doing that, we need to have a system that every node in that system of the future is smart, is price responsive, is adaptive, and is secure. Thank you very much for the opportunity to share with you. I went over my allotted time by about 8 minutes. So I'm at your service, and there's quite a bit more about some of the pieces I mentioned on policy recommendations for the policy. The very last page of these three references at the website that they have for me at the U, the very last page talk about policy dimension and what states, state regulators, state bodies can do to overcome this lack of innovation stalemate. The one from Scientific American from May of 2007 is a good one. So I will be happy to send it to you, but if you like a quick way to get to it, I would say please look at the very last page of these three, which is, if you go to this website, there is a column, a left-hand side column that has selected publications, selected presentations, selected videos. Under selected publications, you will see these three. And if you like, I'd be delighted, honored to send it to you for your basically consideration. Madam Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Amin. Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I feel like I just had a semester course in about an hour and a half. But we recently toured a IT facility that had a battery backup. It was like 900 batteries, and it would only back the system up for maybe 10 minutes. So what do you envision the storage looking like?
Excellent question, Senator Olsen. It is most IT data centers, there are three things that can be done. Number one, you need that fast charge and fast discharge batteries. As soon as the power goes out, they kick in, they support your servers. But the tier under it are the diesel generators or natural gas generators, or some are more sophisticated. They have hydrogen fuel cells that are the size of a dishwasher with a six-pack of natural gas drop next to them that connects into it. Those take about a few seconds to kick in. So to enable what we call uninterrupted power supply, the batteries kick in right away within a fraction of a second. then those bigger generators, either diesel or natural gas or hydrogen fuel cells, kick in right after that. But all of this being said, how long do you think they're good for? At most. Depends on the megawatts you need. How much they are good for also depends. If you're attacked, if you look at it from a security point of view, if you're attacked and the natural gas or oil fuel supply is taken out, these are good for at most 24 to 48 hours.
Madam Chair.
Senator Alcine.
So then if we take that to a bigger picture, because I've heard some of testimony at this table previously that, you know, they're working on like 1 megawatt storage capacity. And how big a battery is that? I mean, is that as big as this room?
It's about, think of it as the crudest way. Take about car batteries or car batteries. Take the Sears Platinum, whatever, and put them on multiple shelves, right, on top of one another, and fill up this whole room almost like a bookstore or like a library. Instead of books, you have these batteries. The size it would take for 1 megawatt would be probably about a little bit less than the size of this room. How many of you have battery backup at home, similar to what I described in your garage? Some of you are nodding. How long is it good for? Depends. If you only use it for lights for 100 watt light bulb or running a heater when you're in emergency, it's good for a couple of hours. That's about it. So, but there is technology in the making, nano-based batteries. Lithium ion is a lot better than that, but it's more expensive. Nano-based battery, Toshiba, perhaps I shouldn't use the name of vendors because I never invest in anything I know. I put all my little bit of University of Minnesota retirement into things that are all mutual funds, so I have no conflict of interest as I teach or I recommend things. Lithium ion battery, the next generation is nano. Toshiba has a battery that holds 8 times the charge of lithium ion and charges in less than a minute. How? Think of nano. Think of a little sponge that you can go in, and instead of a brick, you have a sponge. You can go in and put electrons, store electrons on the inside of it, as opposed to brick. That's what nano enables you to do. To go inside has locations to hold charge within the battery to keep that 8 times the charge. The price still high, so I think the first application we are going to see is in our PDAs and cell phones, and then over time that's going to be production cost, material availability will go down. We can probably, for 1 megawatt, we can do something the size of perhaps a little bit larger than this table for 1 megawatt storage with that kind of technology.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What caught my imagination was your Smart Grid U proposal to the Department of Energy that they have not yet seen fit to fund, but I was encouraged to hear that you're continuing to keep that flame burning. I was wondering how you were going to do that. Is this going to be rolled into the work of the Smart Grid Roundtable, building a Smart Grid Coalition work?
Precisely, sir.
Okay.
Precisely, Senator Dibble. What we hope, yes.
My apologies. I just need to state your name when you start to speak.
My apologies. I'm Masood Amin with University of Minnesota.
No, I do. I need to just recognize you. So my apologies. That's why I mention you.
Thank you. Senator Dibble, we hope to build that within the Smart Grid Coalition, and not necessarily as one of the 5 areas you saw to decide on pilot projects. And then in partnership with Dick and colleagues in Initiative for Renewable Energy and Environment, as well as Institute on the Environment, to look for funding, to go for funding and create a compelling proposal that we would be able to get private sector as well as federal and state would fund that pilot project.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Madam Chair. How much are we talking about?
For that particular one, the budget was $4 million, $4 million, over 2-year period. And I will be happy to send you, it's a brief proposal, it's only a 4-page summary white paper, which I will be delighted to share with you.
Okay.
That would be useful. Thank you.
Dr. Amin, we did have a proposal last year for the Central Corridor that would allow, that sets it up as a special area in which there would be solar experimentation and smart grid and things like that. But we're a state that's been facing significant deficits for a number of years now, and I'm just wondering if you have any words of advice about how we can start to move smart grid forward. One of the things we did were the Energy Utilities Technology and Communications Committee, and last week we passed a bill out of this committee that set goals for broadband penetration and upload and download speeds, and you know, maybe it would be helpful for us to have a smart grid penetration goal set for the state. But I was wondering if you have any other suggestions.
Senator Solon, I would suggest, I would respectfully submit, if you could look at IT and telecom as a necessary part of smart grid. So wherever you can, to lay fiber optic lines that would enable the underpinning infrastructure we need for smart grid. So to make it happen, it would be, as a pilot, it could provide triple benefits. Not only it is upgrading the IT infrastructure, it incorporates energy, electricity, and on top of it, can we create economic growth and job creation in that part of the state?
Well, you know, what we have in this country, much like all the transmission that is owned by 405 entities, we have fiber that is owned by probably that many in the state. I don't know. There's, you know, a vast number of them. And so I don't know if I've announced to the committee in the past, but my plans are that after our deadlines that we have an informational hearing about broadband, basically, about fiber and about the telephone companies and the cable companies and the wireless companies and how they interface. And it would be like a communications 101. So that we have as much information as we had when we started energy 4 years ago. Because I think it is important that we do start thinking now about how we use those transmission lines for, or that fiber transmission for more than just the cable and the telephone and the other entities, and how we can make more efficient use of those systems. So I appreciate your comments.
And also, if you recall the tsunami of data, if we really put smart meters in businesses, maybe not homes first, into industrial commercial establishments, the amount of data that they will generate will require an IT infrastructure that would support the terabytes that will go through that those telecom networks.
Okay. Senator Carlson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Mean. I'm always excited to hear you, and I learn so much every time I do listen to you. And one of the things that I'm really sensitive to is you did cover on one of the pages in the presentation what has been developed as far as hardware goes with the, you know, in selling certain products and components, and that's something that I'm real sensitive to, that we need to be sure that that kind of R&D is done here and that we capture as much as we can. So do you have any kind of thoughts on that, as how we can work with our local developers, you know, especially I think Honeywell is heavily into this. How can we make sure that we don't lose the edge on this kind of product development?
Dr. Amin.
Senator Carlson, you raise an on-target, perfect opportunity for large, small, mid-sized manufacturing companies get into it. Currently, most of what those nice pieces of equipment I shared with you are being developed either in parts of California or are developed overseas. They're developed in the usual China, India factories. It doesn't have to be. if you include the transportation cost, all the risks that go into offshoring it, a lot of that we could look into within Minnesota, what can we develop. That's part of our mission in this Smart Grid Coalition, to assess exactly those nuggets. Last Friday, after the meeting with the colleagues for the coalition, we had a brainstorming on something completely different along the lines of what you're asking, sir. With IBM, with Conexus Energy, and with Arcadian Networks, what are unique opportunities that together we can pursue? And some of the things that came up, nobody is doing, and we can do here in Minnesota between the organizations that I mentioned. And we can showcase them in Conexus Energy, that has a very pioneering program in this area in partnership with IBM and perhaps Honeywell, just as one nugget. So imagine that just as a start. There are many other opportunities. Some of the meters you saw, some of the devices you saw, we can build them in Minnesota. We can manufacture them and even look into ways to do it without the bugs. Many of those meters were buggy meters. The people could penetrate them. With the security knowledge we have in Minnesota, could we build it with security built in, designed with security built in? So I would love to see that happen and create jobs here.
Madam Chair, follow up. You mentioned some of these components being built overseas. How are we in comparison to those technology centers, for instance, Ericsson in Scandinavia, or some of the areas of the Pacific, like Japan and Korea? Where are they as far as understanding what's going to be needed and what their R&D is like?
Dr. Amin?
Cisco, I give you some examples. Cisco, IBM, Google predict by 2014 the smart grid technology will be a market of $170 billion. $170 billion in 4 years. So they're getting into it big time. They're committing resources, they're committing people into it. The international organizations that are involved in it, China is big time into not just renewables, but smart grids. $700 billion Chinese government has committed to integration of renewables into their system, does include to make the system smarter. I've visited China 4 times, and the way they build infrastructure, especially on the eastern, on the part of China, which is the more developed part along the coast, they build, they bury it underground. And of course, the cost of it is about 7 to 10 times more to put it underground than overground. Everything, telecom, electricity, oil and gas. It could also potentially be vulnerable. If you penetrate it, you can take multiple infrastructure at the same time. But the benefit of it is, it's not subject to lightnings. It's not subject to external factors that would destabilize the system. And also for maintenance, it's wide enough. It's from that wall to about here. You can drive 2 maintenance trucks side by side for maintenance and inspection. So being a command economy that China is, they are much more, in that sense, agile. They can move in that direction. So again, the business opportunity has been assessed by organizations as large as Cisco and IBM and Google and others, Microsoft. One part which is interesting, Japan has been getting into it also. They're using their gaming machines. Japan is big in gaming. And they're using their gaming machines to enable information to the consumer. So imagine your Nintendo device provides you with your energy use at home or energy footprint, and then the next step that they haven't yet done would be, what does it do for you? How are you going to act? And how are you going to improve your energy system? The good news is IBM owns the lion's share of the chips that go into these gaming devices, Nintendos and so on. So if you will, that is an opportunity we have to use that chip, to use that device, to build technologies around it, with the functionalities, with the services that we want to build for the smart grid.
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, do you mind if I just make a comment? And thank you very much, Dr. Amin. We've heard so much recently about the need to innovate. And we were at a legislative conference, a lot of us, just a week ago, hearing about how successful governments are innovating. And I keep going back to this idea that we heard from our state economist and our state demographer that in the future, as Minnesota, you know, over the next decade or so, as our population ages and our workforce age, population shrinks. And by I had Tom Gillespie at my town meeting last weekend, and he said, he reminded us that by 2020, we'll have more people in retirement age or after older than age 65 than we have in the entire K-12 system. And their message is over and over, if we're going to be successful, given those demographics in the future, we have to be a state. I mean, the only way to be successful and to compete in a global economy where we have a smaller workforce like that and, you know, less people in the workforce, hopefully when we are all old enough that we don't have to work all the time, we have to be innovative and we have to be more efficient. And that's the only way we're going to add value to our economy. And so to me, this is such a critical part of that and how we get the smart grid. I mean, the smart grid is sort of that what that picture is in the energy world, I think. And I don't know, Dr. Amin, I was listening to you eating my lunch when you started, so I apologize if you said this, but when I went to a smart grid conference in October, and there's probably like 1,000 smart grid conferences around the country this year, and so the same, I heard the same line 47 times just in one 24-hour period, but I don't think I heard you say this. Everybody says, you know, if Alexander Graham Bell looked at the communication system, he wouldn't recognize it. But if Thomas Edison looked at our electricity system, he'd say, hey, that looks just like it did when I left. And that just tells you, you know, we're just not modern. We're not where we need to be, and we have all the parts. We just have to put them together, and we have to figure out, as you said, how we're going to pay for this and who's going to do it and who's going to pay for it. But I don't think we're going to be successful, especially at getting our renewable energy future to be as strong as it could be. We're just not going to be as successful as a state unless we see this happen in Minnesota. So that's my long, wordy comment. And thank you for all the information.
Dr. Amin, did you want to make comments?
I wholeheartedly agree with Senator Anderson. This is a great opportunity, and we must leverage the brain power, the capability, all the way from the companies, the state's progressive approach to energy, as well as the university assets. When I shared this with my colleagues in not this presentation, but earlier presentations, there are president of IEEE Communication Society is my colleague at the U, Professor Moskove, who is the associate dean for the Institute of Technology. He would love to participate in it. Mm-hmm. Colleagues in the electrical and computer engineering that do chip design, that are gurus, national names on developing chips, smart chips. Colleagues who work on the wireless, pioneers in the wireless technology, they're all excited. We would love to support our state in all of these areas that I shared with you. We can do it. And if we want to lead our nation, we must do it. And it's not a question of doing it just for us. We will do it for our whole region, from Manitoba, entire MISO region. And then we would love to develop technologies that we can sell globally. We can sell these technologies to China, to India, to other parts of the world that are developing in this area. So I share your passion. This is critical, and it can be done. It can be developed. And I agree that that same observation about Alexander Graham Bell is right on target. I've heard it as well. Our system, our electric power grid, is a marvel of engineering for the 20th century. For the 21st century, we can do more.
I have one question. You mentioned that coal generation has a energy efficiency of 31% to 50%. Can you tell us what it is for nuclear energy?
Nuclear is very high. Nuclear is in the 90s. And actually, there are 103 reactors in our nation. These 103 reactors provide 8% of total energy. Total energy, 20% of electricity in our nation. And when you look at what was passed in President Carter, who He is a distinguished nuclear engineer himself, nuclear submarine commander in his former careers. We didn't enrich uranium anymore. Why? Because of the cost of enrichment of uranium and because of concerns over proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. That uranium, spent fuel, is still radioactive, still has energy in it. It can be put, as French have done successfully, as Japanese have done, can be put back. You can even increase the efficiency, push it in the mid-90s, high 90s range by putting the spent fuel back into the cycle. And that takes away the concern about where to store them, Yucca Mountain or who, transportation of those through interstate highways is taken out also. So when I share with you, perhaps this is improper, but when I was an undergraduate at University of Massachusetts, electrical engineering, there was a lot of debate about nuclear. And at the time, I thought, I took a look for myself. I decided, look, I'm an engineer, I'm a scientist, I'm going to look at it for myself. The lessons I came to is the following. Population of the world is growing. At the last century, by 1950, there were two cities that had 10 million or more people in them, London and New York. Currently, as we speak, there are 18 cities that have 10 million or more. By 2020, there are going to be 30 such cities. By 2050, there are going to be 60 or more such megacities. Out of this population, only, actually, there are 1.4 billion people who have no access to electricity. Another 1.2 billion have inadequate access. Assuming the same ratio, that 40% of the people of the world will not have access to electricity or have inadequate access. They have outages of 4 hours or longer per day. For the remaining 60%, the total production, global production currently, is about 4,000 gigawatts. That need to triple by 2050. To get to that place, sources that we have, there is no silver bullet. We're going to need all our energy resources that are available, that are affordable, with the caveat of making sure that the environmental footprint is either near zero or is zero. So bringing this into the picture, a risk-managed approach to all of our energy sources brings nuclear back to the table. So nuclear has to be revisited and has to be part of the mix. And I don't say it as an advocate. I say it as a scientist, as an engineer. It has to be part of the mix. Okay.
Any other questions or comments? Well, thank you, Dr. Amin. This has been very, very informative and a very exciting presentation. Thank you.
Madam Chairperson, I'm honored and I'm at your service. My colleagues are at your service. Anytime we can support you. Thank you so much for the honor and the privilege of being here today. Thank you.
And with that, we will adjourn the meeting, but I just want to tell you that on Thursday we have three bills up. One of them is about a sad case of a young person who was assaulted and murdered because they were unable to get permission to trace her cell phone. And they were able to, she was missing for 4 days, and then 45 minutes after they did obtain permission to use the tracer on her telephone. They were able to find out where her body was at that time. And so we would like to change some laws regarding the ability to access that information, that location. That isn't so controversial. I mean, the telephone companies are behind it, and I think everybody supports it. But there are two bills that are very controversial. And we need to start on time, so I'm hoping that you will all be here as quickly as possible on Thursday to hear those bills, okay? And with that, we'll adjourn the meeting. Thank you. Guys with